two items discussed in closed session. The first, direction was given to legal counsel on anticipated litigation, and the second will be brought up in open session at the end of, it's at the end of the agenda. There's no report to that yet.
Okay, thank you. So with that, Mayor, are you up for the city auditorium or is Howard?
Howard can be there. Oh, our fearless leader has decided to join us despite his fever and flu, but I'll speak in his weak state. So on the CEO report, I'll just start with a quick announcement. We have two new employees for the organization. If you could maybe stand and join us for very brief comments. But we have Jason Bartlett, who's our finance manager, who just started this week, and Fedek, who is our new outreach fellow, our second of two outreach fellows, and she just joined us 2 weeks ago. So Jason joins us from Oakland Unified School District. I don't know if you want to say any words, but you know, feel free to introduce yourselves.
Don't need to press the button, Jason.
There it is. Hello, I'm Jason Bartlett. I have several years of experience in private energy as well as finance and rate setting consulting with public utilities. And as Howard mentioned, I'm recently coming from the capacity of a budget director from OUSD. And I'm really excited to be here.
Sorry, what is
it? OUSD, Oakland Unified School District.
Okay.
Thank you. No update on the executive committee meeting. We do have a marketing and outreach, and I'll update that Andy Anderson's going to come on.
Good evening. So I provided a table of some of our enrollment information. Thank you, Stephanie. So I broke this up into both totals, so our total enrollment, but then phase one and phase two. As we roll out to our residential customers at 500,000 accounts, I think it's important that we sort of tease out these details. So you can see, I think the important numbers here are opt out. Overall, we're at less than 1% from our phase two. This is only at about 0.5%. This is as of the time that I've read this report, and I'm going to show you later sort of what we're seeing on a day-to-day opt out. I did, for the opt-out numbers, they're looking really strong, looks great. I did then pull out Albany, Hayward, and Piedmont, since those are the communities where customers were defaulted onto something other than Bright Choice. When we look at that, we have a very strong commercial opt-up rate, and that is primarily due to the municipal accounts that opted up. So enrollment by program, also wanted to present to you how these numbers are distributed across Bright Choice, Growth 100, and Renewable 100. The Brilliant 100 numbers are largely driven by the enrollment of Hayward in their phase two default into Brilliant 100, and then the Renewable 100, I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying that is from Piedmont. Right now, we don't see any commercial customers that have opted up to Renewable 100, but we are just moments away from getting our Green E certification on Renewable 100. With Green E certification, that service now adds points to LEED certification, and we know of at least two commercial customers that have already approached us saying that they want those additional points and intend to opt up. So here are our opt-outs by day and by channel. You can see that this is starting at the beginning of September, so when we launched, meaning that all of our residential accounts were then in our system, loaded into our system, customers could go to our web forms, opt, down, or out. So starting back September 3rd, and then going through basically the end of last week. You can see that on I tried to put on here when those notices were mailed. You can see that as we number of people receiving notices, we did then see additional opt-outs. Those spike pluses always seem to occur on Mondays. We did have an unfortunate event where we had a glitch with our technology and the web forms. This resulted, we identified the issue, we weren't able to solve it right away, so we took the forms down. This happened, unfortunately, for 2 consecutive weekends. What we did put up was a message that you could still call in to our 800 number, and that there was an automated phone system that would support any actions that an individual would like to take. And then we were able to bring those forms back online. Unfortunately, we continue to have errors. For over 7 days now, we believe that we have resolved the issue. We haven't been able to replicate it. I've tried very hard to break it, and we test every day, multiple times a day. It seems to be working, so I'm very glad for that, because the web forms is clearly the preferred channel for people to take an action specifically to an opt-out action.
Andy, what is IDR and REIT?
Oh, sorry.
CSR.
Oh, cool. So IVR is our automated phone system, so when you call up without actually talking to a real person, CSR is a real person or a call center or customer service representative. So that was the update on enrollment and opt-out. I also, I feel like we just met very recently, so I gave a pretty robust update on the marketing outreach that we're doing. I will say, not on the slide here, but we have now gone to over 50 events and reached about 1,500 individuals, so personal interactions. And Debbie, who is new to our team, she is actively working on scheduling sort of town hall or public forums. So rather than going out to meet people in the farmer's market or at some festival, we're actually encouraging people to come and talk with us specifically on EBCE. So the first one will be November 14th in Livermore in the public library. A lot of other conversations have been coming up around social media, specifically Nextdoor, which is a social media platform that is very focused in on based on where you live. So I wanted to give a quick overview and then tell you what our strategy is, because I think this one sort of has touched us all, many people personally, because a lot of people have accounts. And most of us have what's called a personal account. The way they verify this is either a billing address from your cell phone or a credit card, or you have to have a postcard that has a verification code on it. And then once they verify where you live, you can only see those surrounding neighborhoods. So for example, I'm in northern Oakland, and I believe I can see 22 different neighborhoods around me, so South Berkeley, North Oakland. Then there are business accounts, of which we have created an EBCE business account. But a business account is only visible to a user if someone within your neighborhood recommends it. But even after a recommendation, that business cannot see into the discussions within that neighborhood. Third type of an account is a public agency account. I imagine many of your cities and the county have a public agency account. This seems like the way to go, and it does have a lot of good functionality. You can push out messaging to your entire jurisdiction. But if someone starts a thread within their neighborhood, even with a public agency account, you can't see into that. And so then the last way to utilize Nextdoor is through something called sponsored posts, which are essentially paid advertisements. This is fairly new to the platform, and I've made multiple requests. They're still in the testing phase and currently not allowing any new posts.
Are you saying that we have a public agency account, or you're requesting one?
I have requested one multiple times for EBCE. They will not provide. They say right now it is municipalities and but they put like safety, like the fire departments can get them.
All right, thanks.
I'm glad we're talking about this because this was a topic of discussion with some of my colleagues here in the city of San Diego, because just as myself and others staying next door posting in their own neighborhoods, it allows to be using chatter. Opt-outs, so we can analyze our opt-outs by zip code,
and then basically approach the city where that zip code resides and say, hey, can you push out messaging within this community? Even if we're not exactly sure what the threat is about, it does help legitimize what we're doing. Look, we're not a scam, this is a real thing. You know, this is part of what our city council decided. So we can help draft that messaging and also identify which zip codes those are from and work with the city and county agencies to do that. And then I'm continuing to pursue the sponsored posts so that we can get messaging out. Being able to respond to the individual threads of conversation has proven impossible, but I will do my best to provide more information and then ask that people either, I'd also like to see if we can somehow, you know, if you push us that information, we can either draft something for you and ask you to post it, or we can at least track about where the neighborhoods are and then use these public agency accounts.
Yes, and I can tell you that even though I live in the city, there are many more still under one of the next ones. And the city of Dublin sent out a very well-written message probably about a month ago. And I would hope maybe Dublin does it again in this sense, and I've seen chatter about what is this, blah, blah, blah. But it would really be helpful if each one of the cities just sent that same message that Dublin sent out, because it was really pretty important. Well, you want to say second. Motion passed without objection. Thank you. Item 13.
Item 13 is our Director of Power Resources, Bill Herr, will present on the Risk Oversight Committee formation.
Good evening, all. With this agenda item, we'd like to provide some information on the formation of the Risk Oversight Committee and update. So if you remember, back in February 2018, the board did approve the Energy Risk Management Policy, which in general sets guidelines for power procurement activities. It in general defines civil procurement activities as meeting supplier requirements and restricts speculative activities in it. Part of the policy in trying to enforce that is the formation of the Risk Oversight Committee. And so the reasons for forming such a committee are threefold. We need speed and availability, and so have this committee to be able to come in and meet together in sound issues. It speeds up the essence, especially in the energy market where things can be very dynamic and change real fast. The second part of that is having technical expertise. So we'd like members of the RISA operating oversight committee to have technical expertise in the energy industry and understand the risk metrics that we're going to be involved in meeting on a periodic basis. The third element to it is confidentiality. Maintaining that is important because a lot of it involves discussion around confidential terms about our counterparties that if we had disclosed in public, nobody would want to do business with us. The other part of that is that we have market-sensitive information that we discuss in this committee that we prefer not to go out to the public and be disadvantageous to BBC's procurement efforts. And next I'll talk about the duties of the Risk Oversight Committee. So the Risk Oversight Committee is in charge of identifying the risks that are associated with the energy portfolio of BBCE. Mainly they deal with like three elements, volume risk, which is making sure there's no supply out in the market, price risk, the volatility that's involved, and also concentration risk with counterparties, making sure that we're not too vested in too much in just one supplier. So identifying those are examples of what the Risk Oversight Committee will be doing on a periodic basis. The Risk Oversight Committee also develops the risk matrix and the parameters of which we will review. We'll also have regular scheduled meetings to review the portfolio and enforce compliance to the ERP. So an example I give is, say we bought X amount of energy in the month of September, and as we approach it, you know, the summer's been mild and it ended sooner, and now we have less demand, and so we kind of in an oversupply situation. The ROC is designed to kind of monitor that and look at the most optimal way to get out of that or to adjust your position back. Next, I'll talk a little bit about the structure of the ROC. Traditionally, the way the ROCs are formed is you have three lead management members from different functions inside the company. And they break down by front, middle, and back office. And what that means is the front office is typically in charge of planning and executing the procurement strategy. So actually want to do negotiations and such. The middle office has more of a financial perspective and risk oversight controls. They're more focused on that matter. The back office handles the settlements, the payments, the invoice, bookkeeping aspects of the power transactions. And the reason for this three-pronged approach is kind of to have different set of eyes and different functions and perspectives on it. That's been kind of the traditional and the standard for the industry. For our ROC, we want to kind of go out a little bit further, especially since we're forming this from the beginning. And we want to maintain a little bit more transparency in it. So our approach is to incorporate advisory members of the ROC. And so far we've identified a couple that we feel really fortunate actually to have. Rand Ornes, who's the managing partner of E3, the consulting agency. Who's also a resident of Alameda County. Is going to be part of that advisory member. We also have Daniel Hamilton, who is the sustainability manager for the city of Oakland. He's going to be the second member of our advisory portion of our lock here. And then we also have our procurement counsel, Steve Hall, as kind of a legal perspective on the ROC here. So today we kind of just have our first kickoff meeting to discuss the formation of the ROC and develop a chart of it. We have not had an official scheduled meeting to review the action report itself, but we intend to have that pretty soon here. And we imagine that in the beginning we'll have a lot more of the outside of the scheduled meetings to kind of help develop things and fine-tune the policies and such. These meetings are going to be scheduled on an official basis quarterly. Of course, outside meetings outside of that can be called at any time as well, because the market's very dynamic, things move on real fast, and we have that capability. With that, I'll also say what the ROC is not, and the ROC is not intended to be an enterprise-wide risk management group. So this is focused mainly on the energy portfolio a bit, being that we're not a typical utility, we don't have wires, we don't have field personnel and such. So it's not concentrated on insurance, you know, for example, issues and things like that. Mainly on just the portfolio. And the ROC itself doesn't have any extra powers that hasn't been delegated by the board and the CEO, so it will go outside of its boundaries. The ROC also does not make any decisions on the energy mix of any customer programs, so it's not dictate that. And the ROC itself doesn't actually review any bids, offers, proposals, anything like that. They only review as it pertains to the risk management aspect of the portfolio. So that goes as a nutshell of what the ROC is. I'll leave it to questions and feedback.
Other questions?
Was deferred to phase two, a true up of capacity and RPS benchmarks, which is also a positive thing because we don't think that the current methodology would have done that correctly. So the fact that those were deferred is definitely a good thing. It rejected the joint utilities proposal to eliminate vintaging for procurement of certain policy-oriented mandates, and that would have different impacts depending on when customers left and how long they were continuing to pay for certain PCA-eligible resources. It also addresses the fact that phase two is going to look at portfolio optimization and forecasting. These are requests that we've had for a long time when this whole rulemaking was open to say, is the utility correctly optimizing their portfolio? Are they correctly forecasting load when it's departing, when they're making their purchase decisions, so as not to continue to incur stranded costs? Finally, it is asking the utilities to list on their utility customer bills a PCIA charge, similarly to how that charge appears on CCA customer bills. So right now, bubble customers aren't aware that they pay a PCIA, it's embedded in their rates. They become a CCA customer and they say, hey, what's that new charge? And so the commission's actually saying, well, you know, every customer is paying this charge, let's show it on all customers' bills. And actually the final item is that the decision adopts a cap. We wanted the cap to start in 2019. It doesn't start until 2020, but we'll take it. The next slide. So here's some of the things that we think the decision got wrong and that have an adverse impact from our perspective. For starters, we have been arguing for quite some time that the capacity price benchmark used in the PCIA does not reflect actual market prices. It's based on short-run prices and only a small amount of transactions that are actually taking place. It's based on an RA report that the Energy Division publishes every year. We are hoping to work with the Energy Division on that report so that we can get more of the transactions that are happening to be reflected in that report so that it can be more timely, so that when you have scale capacity prices, they're not setting the benchmark, you know, two years later. The decision also rejected our proposal for a GHG-free resource premium benchmark. We pay a premium to buy greenhouse gas-free energy. We thought that, you know, to the extent that the utilities are either selling that or keeping it on behalf of the bundle customer, that value should be realized. The decision did not do that at this time. There is a possibility that in phase two they will consider that, but at this time that wasn't adopted. I think other key things, we are going to be paying the cost of legacy utility-owned generation. That is generation from older facilities, in PG&E's case, Diablo Canyon, and hydro costs predominantly. And so there was a proposed decision out that actually would have no longer had us paying those costs. The decision requires us to continue to pay those costs. Another thing it does is newer utility-owned generation, so primarily newer fossil plants and energy storage have always had a 10-year cap on how long they can be included in the PCIA. The decision removes that cap, so now indefinitely we will continue to pay above market costs of those pieces. And then finally, it rejected our request to cap the PCIA starting in 2019, pushing that out to 2020. So, you know, there are some issues that we're still working through with the Energy Division on implementation here. Of course, everyone's still trying to analyze and understand the impacts. So I'll go to the next slide. And this is our preliminary impact analysis. What you can see here is the current PCIA rate. That's in the 2017 vintage column. 2018 vintage is the same. So then the next column is the decisions PCIA, and so you can see the percent change in the final column. For some rate classes, the rate change is not as significant as for others. Residential customers did fairly well. Small commercial customers, streetlight customers, agricultural customers are among those customer classes that are facing much more significant changes in the PCIA. And so, you know, just when you think about the right choice value proposition, our rates have to be set at a level of 98.5% of PG&E's minus the PCIA and system fees for each customer class. So right now, we can't provide a full assessment of the impact because you need two pieces of information to do that. You need to know what the PCIA rate will be, and you need to know what PG&E's rate will be, since our rates are a discount to theirs. They are due to present an update of their projected 2019 rates for approval in November. And so once they do that, we will have an updated picture that is more accurate than this initial analysis, and we will come back to you once that has been filed and once we've been able to look through it.
Just a clarification, that it's not the percentage change, it's actually the percentage, it's a 4% change for the residential rate, not a 104% increase, right? He's showing that the proposed rate as relates to the old one.
That's right, it's 104% of today's rate.
Yeah, a 4% increase.
That's right, that's right.
But below what's terrifying.
Sorry about that.
Thank you very much. That's right. So in phase two, what are the main issues we're going to be discussing in phase two? And will any of those, depending on how they, what the outcome is, lead them to go back and modify some calculations in phase one?
So I'm going to answer that question backwards. Yes, it's possible that the outcome of phase two could change the calculations in phase one, but I think the ultimate goal of phase two is a real fundamental redesign of the PCIA. So it may look very, very different from phase one. So the current methodology is based on a benchmark. So you look at, you know, what can be best used to approximate the value of what's retained in the utility's portfolio relative to market prices. And to the extent that costs are above market prices, those costs are supposed to be spread to all customers. But again, it's done on a forecast basis, and nobody really knows what the value is of the product that remains with the level customer. In phase two, what they're trying to do is look at opportunities to reshuffle the supply. So one of the things that CalPCA and other parties have proposed is a voluntary auction, where the utilities have to auction off their supply, and market participants can bid and take what they want of that, and the utility can bid for what they want as well. And by doing so, you start to create an actual market price and an actual value for those assets. And then the costs spread to customers become the difference between the original contract cost and whatever the market is willing to bear at that time, and you spread those costs equally.
So you said they auction off the their excess supply, right?
There's different ways to do an auction. We actually recommended that they auction off everything and buy back what they need.
So the theory behind the PCIA is, okay, they have costs that they incur, they have contracts that they're obligated to, they gotta use, therefore we're taking some of the customers, therefore we should make sure that, you know, that they don't have these kind of costs that they're dealing with, and it all evens out because we are now, we're now have our own customers, but we are not really getting a portion of that contract and the energy from that contract, even though our customers are paying for a portion of it.
That's right.
So my little one gets that doesn't make any sense at all.
I think that's why the more meeting was started.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's terribly complex, and I think it took longer than the commission felt that they had to act, and that's why we have a phase one and a phase two.
So will phase two possibly deal with, okay, now that the CCAs should have first right at, you know, basically we're already paying, because our customers are already paying for some of these, a portion of these contracts. Can we not require, can the PC not require the IOUs to give us that proportion amount or transfer proportion amount, or somehow we can negotiate a transfer part of that in order to make our customers who are paying for it to get what they're paying for.
Right, and that's absolutely part of what's on the table. I think the devil's in the details in terms of these contracts all look different. How do you make sure that everybody is getting their fair share of the contracts, if you will? So that's absolutely under consideration. I think the other significant things that are under consideration are general portfolio management. So what has the utility done historically? What is the utility doing today to properly manage their resources? It's not enough to just enter into contract 10 years ago and then charge everybody forever. What are they doing to minimize costs going forward? What are they doing to shrink their portfolio as load departs? And then what are they doing to forecast load departure as they enter into new contracts?
Okay, that makes sense. But phase two could be much more intricate than phase one, which was extremely complicated. So the utility owned generation, they own it, right? That's by definition. So they're going to produce the energy from that, and for their customers, and we are now going to be paying, our customers are going to be paying for some portion of that based on the cost that they have incurred because that generation, those plants exist. What's to stop them from, so we're paying for part of that, but they're still generating all this electricity. Is there a potential for them to be able to double dip and get paid, essentially get paid twice?
So we're actually only paying above market costs of those plants running, and they do have, when they established the right to collect rates from customers, they were entitled to a revenue requirement, which has a built-in shareholder return. And so they are allowed to collect that revenue requirement each year from customers. And so we are part of the customers they're allowed to collect that from. Under the current PCIA, that's already how it worked. The difference is you had two buckets. You had the legacy utility-owned generation that we've been paying all along, and you had the newer generation that we were only supposed to pay for 10 years. So under this decision, that 10-year cap is lifted, and so similar to the legacy utility-owned generation, we will now be subject to the cost of that utility-owned generation revenue requirement going forward.
And is there a year as to, like, if they're going to create new utility-owned generation next year, but if it's too late, we're already here, that's like playing games. Was there some year cutoff?
There is, based on, it's called the vintaging rules. It depends on what year you depart. Unfortunately, if you depart early in the year and the utility signs contracts later in that same vintage year, you are still subject to those contracts.
I'm talking about utility-owned generation.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the same rule. So the current utility-owned generation is energy storage. So to the extent you're still within the vintaging year, if they build new energy storage, then you are subject to those costs. They, in fact, filed an application last year for a significant amount of energy storage that our customers will be subject to under the PCIA.
That's going to make it take advantage of game that. Is that possible? Are there safeguards to prevent the gaming of that?
There's a lot.
Okay. Thank you. This was really complex. Thank you for all the work you guys have done. I'm going to be delaying on this.
Anybody else? Thank you, Melissa. Part 7.
So I just want to make a few remarks as a steering committee member of the California Alliance for Community Energy, which is an organization of statewide advocates for community choice programs in California. Just to let you know what we're thinking about all this, first I want to thank Dan Cal for actually being at the hearing, even though it was quite clear from how well the remarks had been prepared in advance that they already made their decision before any of the 30 people who were there and spoke against the alternate proposed decision were able to speak. We see this unanimous decision for the alternative proposed decision as simply one more in a whole series of actions by the California Public Utilities Commission that show that there is a real problem in California with the state of our kind of energy policy. Utilities Commission, because we think right now they are completely out of touch with what is happening in California's energy system. The rapid growth of community choice programs, as well as the fact that we are committing to very aggressive climate action goals, and the fact that the community choice programs are working much faster to meet those goals than the investor-owned utilities have done or are likely to do in the future, because there isn't really much incentive for them. But the other thing is that the community choice programs offer huge benefits to communities outside of rates, outside of even cleaner energy, as East Bay Community Energy has led the way in showing by approving and adopting a local development business plan that really should bring huge benefits, especially over time, both in cleaner energy, but also in increased business opportunity and addressing issues of equity in communities in Alameda County. So we'll be there fighting the fight as we go forward.
Thank you, Barbara. Are there any other questions? Are the 1,000 private citizens and community advisors committee work on? This is an action item. Is there a presentation?
The function plan is going to be presented by Emily.
Well, she's a board member, right?
Yeah, I said the same.
Oh, I'm sorry, my mistake. I'm sorry, Melissa's presenting. My apologies.
I can cover this one. So the Community Advisory Committee has updated their work plan, and you have a copy of the updates that they've provided. So we bring it to you for your approval. They had an older work plan, I think it was from about a year and a half ago, that the board had previously approved. This newer work plan incorporates the principles from the older work plan and also adds a few areas of focus.
Okay. I also believe the executive committee looked at this. Did we actually make a recommendation?
We made a recommendation to forward this to the board. But we didn't give comment.
Okay. Anna, did you want to make any comments?
So the amendments to the work plan that are in front of you are the result of quite a lot of work on behalf of the ad hoc committee, subsection of the advisory committee. We went through and we rewatched the board meetings where the direction what the community advisory committee would look at, what values we would hold when the decision to form this CAC was made and when the original work plan was submitted and approved. It did actually go over a couple meetings. It was a really fascinating watch. Then we went through the GPA and tried to put the document in front of you in a couple sections. So the first one is, these are the guiding principles and the lenses through which our committees, subcommittees, ad hoc working groups, whatever, these are the values that we hold. So it's social, economic, and environmental issues and justice. These are the areas that we expect to focus on. And then when this is approved, we expect to come forth with more very specific projects, like this is what we're looking at around the local development business plan, or this thing has come up. Like, I don't believe that we could have anticipated the PCIA, but as these things come up and we're responding to that, we want to make sure that the values of the board and the values of the JPA are clear to the CAC and that we are always following those guidelines. We can bring it to the executive committee. We got some very positive feedback on how it was written, the only feedback we received was the addition of the word regulatory, so that word was added, and that is the document that's in front of you. We've had lengthy discussions, we've had work with staff, brought it to our advisory committee where it was approved unanimously, brought it to the executive committee, and now
Power Alliance would like to thank the folks of the community, advisory committee, who put together this work plan and updated it. So we support it, and we're very excited about moving forward with, you know, really focusing on creating jobs and resiliency, et cetera, et cetera, those mentioned earlier. So thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. Okay, any other questions, comments, or a motion?
So,
sorry. Motion, done, motion, for someone?
Yes, sir.
Oh, is that something? No, you have a question?
No.
Oh, I saw you before, sir. I'm sure. Okay, motion by Erin, second by Paul. Is there any objection to that motion? Okay, motion's adopted. Thank you for your report. Item 16.
Item 16 is related to insured cash sweep. And for this action item, we're seeking approval to authorize the CEO to execute the insured cash sweep deposit placement agreement and related documents with River City Bank to establish a mandatory interest-bearing account for excess cash balances. The main principles and objectives I would highlight are that using the insured cash sweep account, we would maximize our interest yield while mitigating any unnecessary risk. We'll remain sufficient liquid to operate efficiently and, of course, comply with all federal and state laws as it relates to banking requirements. We evaluated two interest-bearing accounts. One is a money market account, and the other one is an insured cash sweep. And the really main differences I'll highlight here is that the insured cash sweep has a higher interest rate. The last we checked, it was 2.1% relative to a money market account, which was 1.7%. And so there was roughly a 0.4% premium on the interest by going with an insured cash sweep. These rates generally have been increasing over the last several months, as generally money interest rates have increased. The other difference is that the insured cash sweep, it is FDIC insured, it's 100% FDIC insured, but there isn't specifically collateral held by the bank, and that's the reason why they're able to offer slightly higher interest rate for this account relative to a money market account, which has a higher, over 100% collateral requirement as part of that money market account. So those are the main differences to highlight. I'll just note for kind of legal purposes, the interest that we would gain from such an account. As an example, if we maintain the balance of $10 million over the course of a year with an insured cash sweep account, we would earn $210,000 over the course of the year from interest through holding that balance in the account. So with that, I'll open up to questions.
No, are there any questions? All right, motion on the item.
Okay.
Second by Richard Manchi. Any objection to the motion? Motion passed without objection. Credit card policy.
Credit card policy, we're seeking approval of the EDC, proposed EDC credit card policy, which is attached, as well as authorize the CEO to enter into a credit card agreement with American Express for administrative travel and small budget expenses. Included in that will be expenses such as cell phone service, office supplies, travel, conference registration, work-related meals and refreshments, and certain other small miscellaneous expenses. The cards would initially be issued only to the CEO and myself, the COO and treasurer. We would like to and intend to revisit this in 2019 with the board and potentially issue the card to additional personnel at the director level and above. But we would take that back, of course, for approval. Just a few items I'll highlight in the policy itself. We're, of course, focused on the controls over the card. So, as already noted, the cards will only be issued to two employees up front. They'll have a monthly credit limit of $10,000, and they will only be used for approved business-related expenditures and in no way for personal expenses. And then I'll also highlight the expenses, accounting, reporting, and payment process. I think this is an important area to focus on in terms of controls. In particular, with the recent hire of the finance manager, he'll have to take a responsibility in reviewing invoices, receipts on a regular basis, on a monthly basis, in conjunction with our credit card statements and make sure they're reconciled. We'll be required to retain and provide receipts for all expenses over $10. But certainly, I'll highly encourage retaining all receipts for you know, all expenses regardless of dollar amount. And then lastly, I'll just reiterate, you know, policy enforcement is that this card is only for business-related purposes and expenditures, and in no way for any personal expenses. There are two revisions that I'd like to just bring forth. One is in section 4 on card usage. There's a sentence in the second line that says the card is issued by American Express. And certainly at this time, we have not gained approval from American Express for a credit card. There's anticipated 60 to 90 day underwriting process there. So I would seek approval from the board to strike that language because we don't want to be restricted to only one credit card provider. If we did want to elect to choose a different credit card provider, we would take that to the board for approval. But in the policy itself, I'd rather have that agnostic. And then the other revision is in section 6 related to expenses, accounting, reporting, and payment. So number 4 under that, the last sentence reads, in the case of the CEO expenses, the expenses will be provided to the chair of the board for review, but do not require sign-off. We'd like to actually revise that so that it is provided to the chair of the board for review and sign-off, but in no way will we hold on paying the actual credit card without that approval, so it will be sort of implied that approval is received if by the credit card payment due date we haven't received that formal approval. And that's it for my
are there any questions out of Mr. Lucas? Director Belch and Director Culp.
Which section did you want stricken?
On section 4, where it says card usage, second line says the card is issued by American Express, who wants to strike that, correct?
That's right.
Okay, that seems perfectly fine.
It may be a Visa card.
Right, got it.
We're not sure. Are we trying for the American Express cards?
We are. We're in the underwriting process, but they're new to the CCA industry, so there's no guarantees that we actually be approved.
And then under section 5, there appears to be an error. I don't know if it's a 1 and 2 are duplicates. I don't know if there's a missing section or there should only be two sections there.
I don't believe there's a missing section. I'll confirm that, but you are certainly correct. There's just a... We're just repeating the same bullet point in 1 and 2. Okay.
I'm sorry, I want to make sure I follow what you just said.
5-1 and 5-2 are the
ones missing. Oh, okay. All right. Let's get it. Okay. Next catch. Anybody else?
Yeah, thank you. A couple questions. One, I think it goes without saying, because this is the case no matter what, but any expense, or any credit card, anybody trying to use a credit card, any expense, whether it's $9,900 or $99, it has to fall within our budget, or our approved budget. It can't be something outside the budget. That's obvious, but that should be said.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying. And two, who, when these credit card bills come in each month, who reviews them? Is somebody reviewing them on staff who is not on the credit card holders?
That's right. So the finance manager, Jason Barley, will be reviewing that in addition to our accounting manager, Mark.
All right.
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you.
Also, the chair will look over the CEOs. I don't know why it was just CEO. I thought it was all statements.
I think that was just intended because Nick would review mine. But
yeah. So the chair will look at. They'll send it over in a timely manner. You have so much time to look at it that you can hold up the payment because Nick's years it sits on. For example, my desk all August, then we miss the payment. He doesn't want that to happen, so he wants to make sure that he assured me and his future chairs that he will be over as soon as possible, and as long as we're diligent, getting it back, it can be approved by the time it goes paid. Okay? You got that? Okay? Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, we'll do it. Alright, anybody else? Then I'm fishing for a motion. Is there an objection, Roger?
No objection, but just noted that the section under 4 specifying annex to be stricken.
In addition to the other amendments or changes that staff asked for. That was the nature of the motion, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Any objection? Motion passed, objection. Item 8.
item 18 is carbon emission benchmarking and accounting methodology. This is an action item, and we took this forward last month as an informational item to review. Mainly this is the same information. For this item, we're seeking approval for a calendar year 2018 emissions factor benchmark to be set at 142 pounds of CO2 equivalent per megawatt hour for the Brushless product specifically, and utilizing the electric power sector protocol by the climate registry as the carbon accounting methodology to calculate this, this figure. That's just a very quick recap of what we covered last time. We did evaluate multiple carbon accounting methodologies, two voluntary methodologies and two mandatory methodologies. The climate registry is a voluntary methodology that a number of other CCAs and PG&E utilizes, so it allows for sort of a uniform methodology across the industry. The other one is the global protocol for communities, and this is one that cities adopt, but it's actually not particularly relevant for the electric electricity product itself, and so that's why we're recommending the climate registry as a more suitable platform to utilize. The other two are mandatory platforms. One is called the Power Content Label, which we're familiar with today. It only includes power percentages. It doesn't include any emissions intensities, but there are currently proposals to add emissions intensities to that process. And then the last one I'll highlight is the Clean Net Short GHG Calculator methodology that's utilized for the IRP process by the CPUC. Both of those, again, are mandatory. They're still subject to some change, and they are very sort of California-focused as opposed to the climate registry, which takes a broader sort of global emissions perspective. By choosing an accounting methodology, this one will enable us to have a clear measurement protocol for which we'll go out and procure energy. Multiple third-party consultants have sort of informally advised EBC to utilize the climate registry as a universal platform. The one thing I'll note is that, you know, based on any future regulatory requirements or changes to industry norms, EBC staff may advise the board in the future to change, add, or eliminate the use of climate registry, depending on what the changes are. The next area I'll highlight is the emissions benchmarking itself. We want to seek approval for setting that at 142 pounds of CO2 equivalent per megawatt hour for 2018. For subsequent years, staff may establish new benchmarks with approval from the board to continue to reach its carbon reduction goals. There is some pending legislation, as I noted quickly, in the power content label and the clean energy methodology. And to the extent there are some changes, you know, they could have impacts to some of the renewable energy products that we are currently procuring. And if so, we'll bring that back to the board for review and discussion. The last item that I'll just briefly highlight here is part of the reason that we want to establish this clear emissions benchmark is because clearly there are different emissions intensities, emissions factors for various energy sources. We want to make sure that we have a methodology that accounts for that as we make procurement decisions and seek that approval from the board to ensure that we are aligned with how you want us to go out to market and procure energy. With that, see if there's any comments on board.
Sure. I request sort of. Obviously, you'll be doing the calculation of our benchmark on an annual basis, as will the other CCAs and PG&E, presumably. At some point during the year, when it's appropriate, so you can collect data. I'd like to see a comparison of how we're doing compared to other CCAs and PG&E to the extent that the data is readily available.
Yeah.
So that up, are we reading the pack, are we falling behind, are we need to be better? I think that'd be a useful thing to include on an annual basis.
Okay, yep, and that's certainly a reason why we want to seek approval for the climate registry specifically, since we know other CCAs and PG&E uses that.
I just want to make sure that comes to the board.
Okay.
So, I guess there's an objection, I'll move the...
Hold on, let me just ask a couple questions first. Are there any comments, questions?
Go ahead.
I'll move the staff recommendation.
Second, my command. Okay. Fair motion second. Is there any objection to the motion? Motion passed without objection. Thank you. Board member, staff announcements, including request for these items on future agendas.
Just one quick announcement. Stipends for your July meetings through September meetings went out today, so you should receive them shortly. And the CAC, the stipends, from July through September have gone out today.
Yes, Director Dimitri Mouch.
Well, it's not a, it's a question. I don't know if anybody else got it, but Assembly Member Bill Quirk had sent a letter to Nick dated October 16th, which was yesterday, so I just want to make sure that somebody on staff is responding to his letter, assuming he's got it on.
Yes, we have received it, and we've been reviewing it, and we're planning a response, a formal response to that right now.
What's the letter about?
He's addressing issues, actually, one of the things he was addressing was asking that the start date be pushed back from November 1st because he, as well as constituents, have concerns about opt-out. There is five different issues here that he's concerned about. But it was addressed earlier about the website glitches. What else here? He was wondering about the PUC's recent decision impacting the EDC costs. Let's see, and he was concerned about the notification process. How many times did EDC attempt to inform customers of the transition, et cetera, et cetera?
Three more times than other PUCs.
Okay. Well, anyway, I just wanted to.
It required three, we did four, really four, correct?
That's right, yeah. Four required.
But in any case, just.
Yeah, I think staff should respond, but I don't have any appetite for that. That's okay.
Oh, no, no, that's why I kept quiet earlier, because everything was going on, but I just wanted to make sure he was responding.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right. Yes, sir.
That our staff will be doing a pre-work talk on residential energy and electricity provided with our residents on October 30th, just getting to know who the community energy is.
So,
one more. Sorry, just a correction to the bottom of the agenda.
Sorry.
Yes. November 5th is actually the CAC meeting. The board meeting will be on November 7th. That's one of your agendas, so you'd have to adjourn to November 7th.
All right. You know, we're having lots of fun. Anybody else? I'd like to meet November
7th. Yes. The board is November 7th.
Right.
So we're going the first week.
And okay, so that's the switch, because that's the first Wednesday, not the second.
Right, so the board did select to have the first and the third Wednesday of the month, and the first Wednesday was only used if we required 2 meetings per month. Since the third Wednesday falls the day before Thanksgiving, we're scheduling it for the first week.
Thank you.
It's awesome. All right.